thought I'd go around the table and have us introduce ourselves to you, so you'll just have an idea of who's on the task force, if you wouldn't mind.
Okay.
Sort of disembodied voices, but it'll give you an idea. I'll have people say not just their name, but also what organization they represent.
Okay.
So, Holly, do you want to start?
Holly Edwards, Charlottesville City Council.
Mark Fletcher, University of Virginia.
Mike Gaffney, Ravana Water and Sewer Authority.
Chris Lee with the Charlottesville Regional Chamber of Commerce.
Tom Jones, speaking for the residents along the reservoir.
Karen Joyner, Ivy Creek Foundation.
John Martin, Ravana River Basin Commission.
Ren Olivier, the Sierra Club.
Liz Palmer, the Albemarle County Service Authority.
Ridge Schuyler with the Nature Conservancy.
Dee Dee Smith with the Citizens for a Sustainable Water Plan.
And Sally Thomas with the League of Women Voters. Now, here's a test. Could you hear all of us?
I could hear all of you, yes, ma'am.
Oh, that's terrific.
But okay. Don't test me on the names.
No, no.
Who's this speaking now?
That was Rich, right?
Yeah. I wouldn't pull that stuff.
I remember the guy that could sell sand to an Arab. I definitely remember you. It's your voice because you did the presentation so well when we were up there last time.
All right, you earned your $10.
Okay, well, I think that we've all read or listened to the presentations that you made earlier, and also Gannett Fleming's their PowerPoint and also their report. We've also been talking about the reservoir for 3 months now, I think it is. And we've been learning a lot of things, including, I think some of us were surprised to find how much hydrilla there was. So we've been out on the reservoir. I think that we still have questions about dredging, even though your report when you were here was a very thorough one. And I think we all learned a lot by listening to that all over again. The Charlottesville Tomorrow people have it on their website, and they very kindly gave us links to it, so that's why we've been able to listen to it. You can listen to yourself anytime you want to. We're not organized as to who's going to be asking questions, so these are just going to be the questions that we each have on our mind. Does anyone want to start?
I guess I would start with an open-ended question. This is Tom Jones. I attended the meeting that was, as I recall, back in May, and listened to it again recently. Is there anything else that you'd like to start off with in terms of updates or any further information from what the questions we had asked regarding dredging or our situation before we start getting into specific questions?
Well, to be honest with you, I really don't. I mean, once we were up there and came and did our presentation up there, and then once, I guess it would be Water and Sewer Authority went to do the dredging task force, which you guys are dealing with, to find out whether dredging was even something you wanted to pursue or study further. To be honest with you, at that point, we kind of backed off to wait and see what you guys wanted to do and didn't delve any deeper into it. You know, everything we've done so far has been kind of a pro bono kind of thing, and we got to that point where it was, you know, if you guys weren't going to choose to move forward with anything with the reservoir, then, you know, we kind of backed off of it and let y'all see what y'all wanted to do. So the answer is no, I really did never move forward with anything else.
Okay, that's understandable. Right. Did you have another question, Tom?
Well, there was a question that we were talking about as we came in, the question of there some comments that people have made that there were trees left on the bottom of the reservoir. We don't know how extensive they were or exactly where they were, but what would be the effect if there were standing trees left in portions or all of the reservoir when it was flooded?
Stumps,
I guess.
That has a significant effect. As a matter of fact, that's one of the things we talked about when we looked at investigations of the reservoir. If you've got, even if they were clear cut and the stumps were left, you're looking at some issues in the types of dredging and the cost for dredging in those areas. If they're digging in a stump field, you know, the machines aren't designed to dig that kind of material typically. They're looking at unconsolidated sands and silts and gravels. If they're having to dig stumps and they're having to clean chokes out of the dredge pump rather frequently, then you're going to be looking at higher costs. And that was one of the things that we felt that you should look at and find out in more detail prior to jumping into the dredging to find out if that was the case. You know, I think we had talked with Tom a little bit and asked about whether there was an as-built as far as for the clearing and grubbing plan of the lake prior to filling. And I think there was a plan, but there wasn't an as-built that they knew of at the time that showed that everything had been done so that it could be easily maintained. That's something that needs to be found out for sure, because that could affect your costs anywhere from 30% to 60%.
And any bathymetric study would show whether those were there, or would it?
Well, the combination of the types of studies that we were looking at was, one was the bathymetry side scan. The side scan surveys that we talked about show anything that was sticking up above the existing mud line, but wouldn't show anything that was completely covered. When we got into doing the geotechnical, the probings and the samplings, which you would, if you started to find within a lot of your samples, finding, you know, wood within the core, layers of wood within the core, it would be pretty obvious that you'd hit a stump. And those kind of things would lead you to believe that there might be those kind of materials left below the existing mud line, left on the old bottom. So the initial investigations would let you know a lot of that information.
Tom Frederick's in the room, so I'll call out and see, is there anything new from on that line? No, he's shaking his head no. He's way back in the back of the room, so you might not be able to hear him. Yes, Liz?
On another subject, the Gannett Fleming, of course, we still have not answered the question that you told us to answer in the very beginning, which was, why do we want to dredge? But if we did dredge for capacity, we're talking about according to Gannett Fleming, about 14,000 linear feet from the mid portion of the reservoir upstream. You had talked about some problems when we got up into that narrow part of the river up towards Ray's Ford and beyond. I can't remember if you went beyond Ray's Ford. I think you didn't.
I think what we talked about cutting off any dredging activities would be right there at the Ray's Ford Bridge. There were, at that point, what we saw, there was an area where they could have some access for equipment up there near the Ray's Ford Bridge, but that would be on the southeast side of Ray's Ford, or the northeast side of Ray's Ford. And then as you go toward the west further, there was nowhere to access to put a dredge in. And the way the bridge piles are configured, you couldn't get a decent-sized machine underneath that bridge. So that really was the cutoff point for doing anything up there.
How big a access site do you need for the equipment? I know it can arrive by a truck, and actually I got onto the website that has a nice little simulation of a dredge. So we've all seen the sort of the cartoon picture of a dredge. But how big in reality do you need of a stabilized site in order to start the operation?
Yeah, you know, a good acre square is 200 by 200 foot area will get you working. If they've got some more space, that's obviously better. but basically enough space for a crane to lift in, lift the dredge in, and then some area. You need approximately 100-150 linear feet on dry land to start putting the pipe together to do the fusing that they have to do to put that pipe together. But it's a very limited area they need. Right now, we're doing one right now. They're putting pipeline together and putting everything in, and the access area they've got is about 3/4 acre, and that hasn't been a problem. They've been able to work off of that. But that is a completely cleared piece of land, and it's down near water level, so it's really a very nice spot for them.
Chris, at a previous meeting, it was alluded that you could actually, for $275,000, do a study that would give us the cost to dredge Ravana with a cap of 10%, and you would guarantee it. Now, in reading about the meeting, that was about the opposite of what you said. Can you explain what you would do to give us, you know, a semblance of a cost, but also kind of outline all of the other possibilities, the other unknowns in a price?
Well, there are number of unknowns, and I think probably, I don't know that I ever said I would guarantee you 10%, but typically
we would sign that contract today.
All of our estimates. Today, I mean, it's hard to say. If you're looking at a project right now and you're looking in today's dollars and today's market and today's fuel cost, that's relatively easy to do. There are a lot of unknowns that obviously are tied to today's economy, and the major one is fuel cost. We saw shifts, for instance, this year, I've seen shifts in fuel costs, which are 30% of the cost of dredging. In December last year, we were at $3.05 a gallon. Down here, for off-road diesel, it got as high as $4.89, and now it's back down to $2.72. So we've seen this huge fluctuation in fuel costs that would be a real big deal for any dredging project, and predicting those shifts right now is difficult. Mm-hmm. Looking at your dredging plan long term, the biggest unknown, I think you've got some options on the first go round for rehabilitating the lake, and it sounds like there are a couple places that are interested, a couple of private sector folks that are interested in the material. But then looking down the road, if it's found that material is not as good as some people hope, what do you do with it in the future? How do you deal with your long-term maintenance? That's an obvious thing that's hard to nail down. But a lot of these things with the initial cost, figuring out what the logistics are, those are the most important thing, figuring out the logistics, the type of material you're dealing with, and what you can do with that material. Once you have those, you can get a pretty firm grasp on what it's going to cost for the conditions at the site at that time.
When you say that 30% of the cost of dredging is fuel costs, are you excluding the variable of disposal?
I am excluding the variable of disposal. That's correct. That's an actual operations cost. That's in the cost of manpower, the ownership of the equipment, and the fuel to move the material from point A to point B. It's 30% of that cost.
Okay. Brent?
Have you been involved with other dredging projects that are comparable to this one? Or I guess I'm trying to understand how you see these problems as being different from other projects that you're aware of or been working with.
I've dealt with a lot of different projects. The biggest difference that you've got with what we do and what I do day to day is the topography around the site. The fact that you've got the reservoir is down in a pretty deep valley. Anything that you're going to do disposal wise is going to be moving material, probably 60-70 feet uphill. And then when you're looking at disposal areas, you don't have flat ground to deal with, which makes things a little more complicated. It's not impossible, but it is more complicated, and it will take a good bit of thought and engineering to make sure that those disposal areas are can accommodate the material and are also safe, and you don't have to worry about failure of the levees that are constructed or anything like that. Obviously, with the quarry, if that were a site that were chosen, a lot of those things would go away simply because of the way the quarry is configured. But with any other place, those would be the major issues. The quarry, of course, you know, when you walk that, I think that's probably close to 100 foot uphill from the dam. So there's a good bit of lift that's going to have to be dealt with there.
John?
With respect to the staging area, I got a couple more questions about that. Indicated it would need ideally about 1 acre of land. Would that need to be close to a major road with a roadway going from the major road down to the 1 acre in order to get the truck with the dredge on it to the water, number one? And then the second...
Absolutely. I mean, access there is... you're looking at fully weighted loads that you're dealing with, and I don't know what, I'm not going to say, maybe you're looking probably 35,000 pound loads, something like that, counting vehicle and everything, for the dredge, if it's a small dredge, or if it's a segment, you know, sometimes these things will come in, once you get above 12-inch dredge, they'll typically come in 3 to 6 sections. So definitely road access is key. For instance, the site up at Ray's Ford, if you were looking at going in up that way, that place where folks come down and go fishing, there's a nice flat there beside the lake, which is a nice access area. But some sort of entry road would have to be built, would be part of the mobilization to build something where they could actually get down there and access that area.
Would it have to be a paved road?
It wouldn't have to be paved. It would have to be. It'd have to be something gravel, something that would support the loads.
Right.
And you know, to be honest with you, I'm a DOT fella, so I'm starting to talk out of school when we start talking about roads that'll support X number of pounds, etc. That would be better left with someone other than me. But yeah, you'd need something that would support the typical load. But you have haul roads. You've got haul roads that run up there. Again, up by the quarry, you've got haul roads that are unpaved that obviously support some pretty heavy loads.
Second part of my question was getting the dredge off the truck into the water and out of the water. Does a crane pick it up and set it down in the water, or do you need to improve the embankment on the reservoir to haul the dredge into and out of the water?
They'd be lifted in with a crane. That's the easiest way to do it. If you're the two ways to do them are either by crane or when you're down here on the coast, you've got travel lifts which are designed for moving larger vessels, and they do them with travel lifts. But up in your area, it would definitely be done by crane.
And would you store fuel in this 1 acre?
You would need somewhere to store fuel. I would suspect. Or, definitely. You're going to have some kind of shuttling of fuel because you're not going to have access to where fuel trucks could come in and pump to the dredge, from every place that they would be working. And you certainly wouldn't want them to have to stop a dredging operation, possibly move the dredge a mile and a half to 2 miles up the lake to refuel. With the smaller dredges that you're looking at coming in here, they're probably going to be refueling every fifth or sixth day, something about like that. They don't hold that much fuel, so they will have to be doing something to shuttle fuel to the dredge.
Will these questions that have come up tonight be answered by the kind of study that you described when you were here?
Yes, ma'am.
This river is very flashy. That I'm assuming that's no problem. There's just anchors put down, and you don't have to remove the dredge for major storms.
No, I don't think that this would be, you'd be in a situation here where they would, and I don't think from what I've seen of the lake, but I don't know what
it's a river.
The river acts like in a torrential downpour or flood situation. My guess is that they would be able to put the dredge anchors out and put the spuds down and ride anything out that you've got in there.
And
I have seen one situation down here when they opened up Drum Inlet up at the Outer Banks, and the dredger made a miscalculation and wasn't set right, and they did wind up breaking the spuds on the dredge and got sucked through the inlet. But that was, they did have a major miscalculation on what the tide difference was from one side to the other. They wound up with about an 8-knot current, and they wound up with some problems. But typically, these dredges will operate in a 3 to 5 knot current, so you've got water speeds. 3 to 5 knots would be anywhere from 5 to 9 feet per second velocities. So I don't think you would have anything faster than that in the reservoir, but I'm not sure.
We can check. I had a question about the size of an operation, because it may well be that there's a portion of the reservoir that we want to dredge that would be less than the full dredge, and I didn't know at what point an operation gets too small to consider. Is there something you can talk to us about along those lines?
Well, there's economy of scale in everything.
Sure.
The big cost, well, it depends. If the material is very localized and the disposal site is very localized, then there are some advantages to a smaller project. But let's say when you say you might start out, you know, the lower, probably between, say, the dam and up near Earliesville Road, most of that area is pretty deep. Most of it's probably close to the depth of the intake, so there's not a whole lot of advantage to dredging down in that area. So let's say, just for instance, say you're going to go to the quarry, and you've got to bring in, you know, 10,000 feet of line to start with, just to get the project going. Well, you've got several hundred thousand dollars in mobilization there. And the more volume you can spread that out over, the cheaper your overall costs are. But then as you go further up river, once you go another 5,000 feet up river, then you're going to have to bring in, say, another booster pump. And then your unit cost, because you're operating two pieces of machinery, is going to go up. So there is some point where there's a break point where it starts out being expensive, it gets cheaper, and then it jumps back up, and it gets more expensive, and then it gets slightly cheaper, and then it jumps back up. It's kind of not quite a sine wave, but there's sort of a sinusoidal curve where everything gets more expensive the farther you are away. And, you know, those break points in the budget can be analyzed and find out, you know, what you've got to spend and what's the best project for the budget that the authority has.
So right. Your study would show all the different possible cases and how much each case would yield in terms of gallons?
Well, we would certainly look at a number of different cases. I won't say we'll hit every possible case, because there's some things that are, as you all probably know, if you've gone through an environmental assessment process or environmental impact statement, you can get into a lot of what-ifs that don't make any sense. But I would envision in this study examining 3 or 4, maybe 5 different scenarios and what those costs and, you know, what type of project and what size of project that you could feasibly do within your economics.
And can you, in the short term, do you feel you can estimate a cost within this 5 to 10%?
In the short term, yes, ma'am. Once we've got all the information, I think that's fairly reasonable to look at, you know, costs in today's market, and then, you know, there would obviously be caveats outlined for, as you push things out to the future, what the changes in market and what your your points for potential error would be as you got farther and farther out on the total line.
But again, Chris, you're talking about just the dredging portion and not the acquisition of land and whatever DEQ and the Corps would require in the permitting process. And a question along that line is, when we did the tour of the reservoir, there were a number of new, essentially islands that were now attached to the land with pretty good-sized trees along it. And I've also walked along Ivy Creek further up, and it looks like there's potential for that these new islands or new portions of land could be considered wetlands. What's, you know, what's DEQ and the Corps' thoughts on these things? Can we dredge all of those, or could they possibly be off limits?
The answer is yes. I don't know what the Corps' stance is going to be on that. Is it a potential to dredge them? Yes, and there's obviously a lot of capacity that's taken up by those islands and wetland flats that have developed along the side. If I remember correctly, those start up there somewhere around Panorama Farms, and as you go farther north, they become more extensive. I don't know what the Corps' position is going to be on them, but there's a good probability that they will say those are functioning wetlands now, and either you need to keep them or you need to mitigate for them. And as y'all are probably aware, mitigation can be at, you know, ratios of upwards of 4-1. So it could be a very expensive I think that if you needed to dredge them, you could, but it becomes a very expensive proposition.
But your estimate would include the cost of mitigation of those, or are you still just talking about the cost of the actual dredging?
I think in this early stage, what you would, the first cut at this, when you're looking at this and making decisions, I think the first cut should be avoidance and look at what it would cost to dredge, assuming that you have no mitigation. And that obviously limits the volume that you're going to take as well. If we wanted to get into that mitigative, looking at that, I think that's beyond the scope of what we've proposed. That certainly could be looked at, but that's a tough nut. I'll be honest with you. That one's going to be in any place where you start taking wetlands and trying to replace them, especially if you're trying to replace them out of their existing environment, it becomes a difficult thing with the regulators.
But would your study include finding out from the Corps whether those are officially wetlands?
Yes, ma'am. I think that's we can do that. But the Corps is not. Again, as you know, with the permitting process, unless you're actually going for a permit and you're in those stages of, you know, negotiating that, they're never really going to tell you yes or no on something that has that kind of ambiguity to it.
And
so they may give you a feel for which direction to go. At least that's been my experience. They'll give you the I don't disagree answer, which doesn't mean they agree either.
Yeah.
It's kind of that in-between, and then you've got to feel it out, because there are so many things that happen. I mean, it may not be a core decision. They may say, okay, practically, yes, these were, before the lake was built, these weren't wetlands. There was no possibility of them being wetlands. They've been caused by the lake, so practically it makes sense to take them out. But then, you know, you may wind up with somebody, I'm going to use Southern Environmental Law, and it's probably wrong, but you may wind up with somebody like Southern Environmental Law or somebody like the North Carolina, the Coastal Federation, that comes in and really doesn't like the project for one reason or another, and that becomes their point of contention are those wetlands. And so as you go through the permitting process, what you think you were doing could change.
So, Chris, that's why you said in May or June when you were here that there's no way to truly understand the cost of dredging until everything is permitted and it's put out to bid. Is that correct?
Yes, sir. That's pretty much correct. I mean, you can look at what you predict to be your scenario, and you should know. I mean, we should know pretty close what it's going to be, but you're not going to know exactly till the permits come in. And once the permits come in, then you can really tighten up your costs, because the construction side of it, like you said, the land acquisition is a big piece. Permit requirements are a big piece, and they're both big unknowns. The construction side of it, if you're getting down to the point where you're 12, 18 months out from doing a project, it's pretty easy to get that real solid numbers on that. And at that point, you should have your permit, pretty much know what's going to be in the permit. You should pretty much know what your land acquisition is going to be. So you can tighten it up there, but, you know, taking a wild stab at it right now and saying this project's going to cost this many dollars and be within 10% with the information we've got would be difficult.
Chris, is it unusual that you would have an environmental impact study done on this project and you'd get the feedback from DEQ and the Corps as part of that, just like you would any other environmental impact study?
Run that by me again.
Typically, when you do an environmental impact study, everybody in the state and all of the people that have an opinion on it give you their opinion. And
yes.
Why wouldn't you do that on this project, and then you know some of those answers even before you put it out to bid? That's a fairly standard
practice. Oh, no, certainly. That would be done way before you put it out to bid. Be honest with you, one of the worst things you can do in dredging is put a project out to bid before you've got a permit and all the permit conditions. If you do that, what you've done is you opened yourself up to a claim. I mean, that's your contractor says, hey, I didn't think I was going to have to do this thing. I didn't think I was going to have to route my pipeline like this, or I didn't think I was going to be limited to this dredge depth, or there's 900 things that they can come back and say, and all of a sudden your project that you had bid at, $10 million is all of a sudden $17, $18, $25 million because change of conditions. So no, you need to have all of that in place before you actually go to bid. You need to know exactly what we're getting into before you do a bid.
And in your experience, what does that cost you to get to that point, whether you actually do the project or not?
On a project like this, when you've got what we were talking about doing here was your initial feasibility study. And then once you've got your feasibility study, then you're going to go through your permitting process, whether it's an EA, an environmental assessment, or an environmental impact statement. You're going to walk through that process. We should have a feel for what the regulators are going to do going into that. Right now, I would say that process could range anywhere from probably $50,000 to $250,000 to walk through that whole permitting process.
That's a bit of a range.
It is a bit of a range because at this point, I honestly don't know what we have thrown at us. I mean,
okay.
if you started out and said, okay, everything is, for instance, the wetlands. If everything's avoidance, then, okay, that's one thing, that's one decision. Okay, we're not going to touch the wetlands. But if we find out that, hey, we really need to get those wetlands and take those out for capacity, and then we start talking about design and mitigation sites, well, then you've got something totally different than if it's a straight dredging project and going through that.
Wouldn't that logically then, at that point, doesn't that give you the information that you would use for your RFP to put it out to bid?
Yes.
We've actually recently gone through a lot with the Ragged Mountain project, so we might be able to ask Tom to give some information that might relate to that.
And y'all may have, like you said, with the Ragged Mountain, you may have a lot of this environmental stuff, and I just don't have it here in front of me to evaluate it.
Yeah.
I mean, there may be a lot of things. I'm sure there are certain things, for instance, you guys have gone through with your species analysis, probably, you know, your endangered species study. I'm sure y'all have done that on the Ravana as well as the Ragged Mountain site for that project. So there's a lot of that that's probably already taken care of. But I don't have it, you know, I haven't looked at it. I don't know what's there and what's not there.
Sure. Holly, did you have a question?
I have a hypothetical question. So, Ridge, did you want to go?
I have a couple of questions, but so I don't want to take your time.
But my hypothetical question is, and I'm the one on the task force that's been just dreaming about breaching the dam, letting the river be a river. But I was just wondering, what experience did you have with breaching dams and the dredging that it requires, especially with the dam, the height that we're talking about?
To be honest with you, I don't have any experience with that. I'm not sure. I could probably, some of the folks that have been around a while in the company might have some experience with it, but in my 15 years, I don't have any experience with that. So I just really couldn't give you an answer.
But you have experience dredging or developing plans to dredge reservoirs for water supply? I think you mentioned a Mount Clair.
Montclair, our folks out of Baltimore did Montclair, and we also did the San Gabriel Reservoir in California several years ago. So we've done two reservoirs, and then we've done some of the sedimentation studies on the Susquehanna River. There are three lakes, and I'm going to give Holtwood. There are three lakes right in a row. Holtwood is one of them. Safe Harbor, and I'm not going to remember the third one. But those three lakes, in the years that I was in the Baltimore office, we did all the sedimentation studies for those dams, and they were used both for hydroelectric, and I believe they had water supply to those as well.
Right, but they did not dredge, if I recall right.
They did not dredge those at the time. They had previously, they had been stopped in the, this was back in the 90s, up until the late 80s, they had been dredging on a regular basis doing coal dust recovery. And at that point, we were monitoring to see when they were going to need the dredging, but they had not gotten to a stage where the reservoirs were filled in to a point they needed it.
Ridge, do you have some questions?
I do. And first of all, Chris, this is Ridge. I want to thank you for donating your time both before and now to the community to help us wrestle with this problem. So thank you, and we've taken, I know, more of your time than we had anticipated, but if I could indulge on you for just a few more minutes for my questions, and then I think there might be some others around the table. First of all, just to follow up on the question that Mark Fletcher was asking, you mentioned that it would be somewhere between $50,000 and $250,000 to walk through the permitting process. That would be in addition to the cost of the feasibility study, right?
Right. I mean, the feasibility study gets you to a point of, okay, we have a fairly good idea, you know, given a number of scenarios, what this is going to cost, what the, you know, options are for disposal, both short-term and long-term, what the logistical problems of the site are. And so at that point, there's enough information to make an educated, reasonable decision about whether to move forward or to stop. You know, you could find out, hypothetically, we could find out that, you know, they cut all the trees off at a height of 8 foot, and the place is just a landmine for a dredger, and for whatever, because of that, they're going to be limited in equipment and everything else, and it's going to cost $40 a yard to remove this. And at that point, the community may go, man, this just isn't worth doing. Back off, stop here. So we get to that point where we can make the educated decision to move forward, and then from there move forward and walk through the permitting process with the ideas is what we see is the, you know, best probable options.
Right. And you've said that it would not be wise to put out an RFP for dredging without having walked through that permitting process. So what would be the timeline that we're looking at to do the feasibility study and then the walk through the permitting process so that we could get to the point that we might put out an RFP? What can you give us just a rough idea of what that timeline looks like? I mean, is it 3 weeks?
No.
Darn. What if we talk really fast?
I would say Okay, reasonably, just walking through here, looking at the field work that needs to be done to really get a good handle on the site, assuming normal weather, and let's say you start now, so we're also dealing with winter weather. We're looking at somewhere on the order of 6 to 8 weeks of field data collection for the various pieces before you get all of it done. It's not 6 to 8 weeks of somebody out there every day, but lining things up and getting it done, that's about the time frame. Then you're probably looking at another 30 days to where you can take that data. You know, we would also be doing not just the field work on the lake, but other on-the-ground work as far as dealing with disposal options, finding out our land options and what we could do up there. Those would be happening coincident. So let's say 2 months, we've got all the data we need. We got 30 days or 30 to 45 days to put together from that information all your, you know, the cost estimations, the report, make some decisions, give y'all good, hard options to look at. So you're talking, you know, we're looking out there somewhere on the order of 3 months, three and a half months to get through this phase of it. Then with the Water and Sewer Authority, I don't know what it would be to make, what kind of review and turnaround time that they might have to decide to move even further forward. But let's say that's 60 days. So then we're out there 5 months. And then the permitting process, every state's different, and I'm not the one that's the most versed in science, but I would say probably, 9 to 12 months there? Mm-hmm. Would that? I think that would be a reasonable assumption on that. So you're looking somewhere in the 18-month time frame?
Before we could go out for bids.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would say something like that. And then you would be, if you go out for bids, you could have, again, depending on how fast the authority moves, but you go out for bids, out for 30 days, they come back in, 2 to 3 week delay to get before the authority, and then maybe, 30 days to award a contract. So you're looking at 20, 21 months before construction?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Do you have another question?
I unfortunately do.
Carry on.
You have mentioned a couple times this kind of short-term versus long-term with regard to the disposal site, and I know that you've said in the past and then even again tonight that the biggest variable in looking at the cost of dredging is the cost of disposal.
Yes.
If we wanted to obligate ourselves to dredge this reservoir for the next 50 years, what do you recommend that we do with regard to guaranteeing that we have a disposal site that would last us for that 50 years?
And how do you estimate that?
I mean, would you have to buy it? Or do you, have you heard of leases that of a disposal site that would go for 50 years?
Well, there are ways to do it. I would say the investment may be to buy it, but you've got a lot of areas down here at the coast, the Corps of Engineers does this, where they are not the underlying property owner, but they have a dedicated easement to use that land for disposal. If you come down in through North Carolina, the Intercoastal Waterway is a great example. The channel's only 90 feet wide, but the Corps has an easement over private land that's 500 feet wide. And so they have, outside the channel, they have the right to dispose of material. They can prevent anyone from building within that easement. The easements on that down here were 100 years. And there's actually a lot of talk, a lot of people getting excited because those are due to expire here in, I think, 2015. And there are a lot of folks that are now looking at 8 and 10 acre islands that have a wonderful, wonderful view of Mars. They're hoping to be able to develop. That's going to be an interesting topic for the lawyers here in a couple of years as to whether those easements will be renewed or not. But there are ways to do it. You know, totally off the cuff as far as that goes, if you were to buy land, the authority or the town or the county, and buy land to dispose of this material, if you think of it down the road, I mean, what would the value of flat land in that area, if you had 50, 60 acres of flat land up there, that would certainly, you know, as you're disposing on it, you're improving the land. And that seems like it would have some value down the road that could, mm-hmm. could offset some of the costs. I know capitalization of land like that's difficult for public entities to do, but that seems, there's a possibility down the road that you have a very, very nicely improved piece of property.
So your recommendation to us is either we control the disposal site somehow for an obligate ourselves to do this for 50 years. Either we own it, or we have some kind of easement that gives us the right to it for the period that we want, or we have, I guess, in the third would be a long-term lease that would give us that right.
Well, that would certainly be the most likely scenario.
Okay.
I mean, the other scenario is that you enter into some sort of long-term contractual obligation with, you know, a contractor to, okay, you're going to maintain, maybe you do it for 10 years or 50 or whatever length of period of time, but that they're to maintain the reservoir to a certain capacity and the disposal of the material is left on their shoulders, whether they've got to chuck it down the road or whether they resell it or whatever. That's a different option, but you know, in that case, you're obligating them to deal with the disposal issue and not the community.
Right, and if we went that route and they had the obligation to dispose of it, once you got it to their site, that sediment is theirs, and if they wanted to sell it from there, they would be the sellers, not the community.
That's right. I mean, if you don't own the land, once you or have permanent easement or long-term easement on the land, once you set it down, it's somebody else's goods.
And likewise, they have to deal with the permitting.
Yes.
And Chris, you're talking originally about the ease of coming up with a budget price to dredge it, but we're talking about dredging it within 18 months, 2 years of when you do the estimate. How can you, or what's the process of then making the estimate in 25 years and in 50 years? Because we're talking about dredging it, you know, three times over that period, if we actually consider this as part of the water supply plan.
Well, what you would be doing then is looking at it. You're going to look at it in. I would look at it in today's dollars, what it would cost. You'd look at. You know, we've got some information on what the shoaling rates in the reservoir are. So based on the original configuration of the reservoir, some of the surveys that have been done and surveys that we did as part of the study, so you'd have a pretty good idea what the shoaling rate was. So you could pick out over, say you do it every 8 years, maybe that's the number. You can know how much material you're going to dredge during that time, and then look at it, you know, okay, in today's market, what would that be? I get real leery. I've done a couple of them where we did time value of money as if, you know, you were going to put the money away down and earn interest on it and then back it up. And, that gets real complicated and gives you a real feel for what you're doing. But basically, we'd look at what the volumes would be at those different intervals and express them in today's dollars. And so, you know, you've got inflationary issues, so, you know, it may be more actually. And what we say, okay, in today's dollars, it's going to be $10 million down the road to do a maintenance. Well, it might be, you know, 14, but what's the value of the dollar at that point in time?
But does that include the cost of setting it down or just of getting it out? Because if you don't have the disposal site, I mean, how do you quantify what it's going to cost to dispose of it if you don't have control over the disposal site?
Very good point. You know, if you don't have control over the disposal site, then that's an unknown.
Do you have experience with geotextile tubes, which seem to be one proposal for taking the dredged material and putting it into geotextile tubes. You can tell I'm above my level of competency here, and allow those to dry the material by their own weight.
I have quite a bit of experience with geotubes, commonly called burrito bags.
Yeah. Talk about again.
What it looks like. They are a very, very expensive proposition to get into.
Oh.
Typically, when you're looking at geotubes, a 30-foot diameter geotubes, 30-foot circumference, is it's somewhere on the order of about a yard and a half, a linear foot is what you can put into one of those. And just the bag itself is about $20 a linear foot.
Whoa.
So it's extremely expensive. Filling those bags is a very slow operation. Typically, you'll see them used in areas where they're actually using the geotube as a revetment. It's actually a beneficial use of the tube itself, mm-hmm. structural benefit. But to do it just for the purposes of drying the material, there are several other options that I would recommend. There are some things that can be done with some coagulants that will flocculants that'll bring the material out of solution very quickly. And then there's also some centrifuge type operations that as the material is put through a large centrifuge and the material is swung out of the water, those operations are typically less expensive than putting them in geotubes just for the purpose of drying. There are definitely other operations that are less expensive.
Bren?
I just have a question about if one were going to dredge the reservoir to restore it to original capacity, how long an operation is this? Did you have any thoughts? People have talked about trucks going down roads for like months, years on end. Does that have any sense of?
I'm going to be, can someone refresh my memory? I don't remember how many cubic yards they were looking at taking out of the reservoir to restore it to original capacity.
It's 2 million for restoring
it initially.
Right, initially, and then 5 million over the 50 years.
Two million and then 5 million. Okay, 2 million yards. 2 million yards, let's assume they come in with an 18-inch ellicott, so you're looking at about 6,000 to 7,000 cubic yards a day. So you're looking almost a full year, 10 months. 11 months to dredge the 2 million yards.
And I think you said that you avoid wintertime dredging because of possibility of ice, and since a lot of water goes out with the soil, we might want to avoid it when there's approaching drought.
I would say they wouldn't want to dredge in an icy condition, and I don't know enough about the reservoir to say whether that's an issue or not.
Okay.
If it is, thin layers of ice or have their are dangerous to the crews.
So even okay.
I really don't know enough about your condition to make that statement. A hard statement.
Yeah, I was thinking you had made that before. We've kept you a long time, but I think
if it is an issue, but off the cuff, it would definitely be a concern.
Yeah, there are a few people who want to ask a few more questions. Liz?
Just a real quick one on what Ren just asked. We had a local company come and give us some information on dredging if we put it in the quarry. They were going to use the quarry. And what they had told us was that it would take them about 3 years, actually, to restore it to original capacity if they did it year-round. That's probably...
This was using geotubes, and that might be one reason they're slow.
Okay. Yeah. What I would like to know is the place where we're going to dredge is about, the area would be about 2 to 3 miles up from the quarry. What would it look like to get the stuff from the from that site to the quarry? Would you have a tube running on top of the water with barges as little platforms, as some people would say, with a pump every couple thousand feet? Or what would that physically look like?
What it would physically look like is all you would really see is maybe about every mile and a half, you would see a small barge that would be maybe 40 by 20 and hopefully would be covered, but that would be a booster pump barge. The pipeline, when they're full of material, water material, they sink, so that they would fall down and rest on the bottom. So you wouldn't see the pipeline. You'd see this barge sitting there with a pipe coming into one end and a pipe going out the other end. And then, of course, at the far end of the line, you would see the dredge. Assuming it's going in the quarry, you'd probably see a pipeline coming up the hill right down there by the dam and snaking up across the road and up to the quarry. They'd have to do a little gravel road crossing over the pipeline up at that area to make sure there was access over the pipe. But really all you would see is you'd see the booster barges and you would see the main dredge, and you would have a couple of work vessels that were tending those lines, making sure that all the fittings and everything were tight and there weren't any leaks in the line, et cetera.
And the noise issue, the noise really carries with the hills around that area. You don't think that's an issue?
I don't think it's an issue. We have projects here all the time that go 24 hours a day. We're getting ready to start up one right now where they'll actually be working within 40 to 50 feet of the houses 24 hours a day. Not much. The noise... Well, I don't know how to describe it. If you've somewhere between a Dodge pickup and a Mack truck, somewhere in between the two.
That's pretty good.
I want to dredge
down. Karen, I think you had a.
No, it's larger than it's louder than your average pickup truck going down the highway, but it's not as loud as your tractor trailer.
Okay.
So somewhere in between each one of those machines are going to be like that. And it doesn't seem so loud when they're around. It's just kind of when you've got them around, you kind of get used to them because it's a constant, and you don't. It's not like a truck coming by. You don't get that Doppler effect of the wow kind of thing. It's just always this low hum that's kind of in the background, and you really forget about it. You don't even notice it after a while.
I was wondering, do you have a couple of terms of references for a feasibility study that we could look at that might help us make comments on what we think the terms of reference, if we go this way, should cover?
Oh, like a feasibility study?
Yeah, a sample tour.
A reservoir kind of thing like that we've done in the past?
Yeah.
Sure. I can ship one to you. Matter of fact, we brought it up, but we left. I didn't leave it there before. We did one... The one that we did for San Gabriel and Morris Reservoirs over in California, we did back in 2000. I'd be happy. I got it right here on my desk. I'd be happy to ship this to you, so you can kind of see what we do.
That'd be great. You could send it to Rivanna. They
can
share it with us.
And the sample, the terms of reference is what you were asked for. Rather than what you produced.
The RFP, essentially. I guess.
Oh,
yeah.
The RFP of what we were asked for.
Yeah. Or both would be great.
Yeah, both.
That's a tougher one for me to find. Let me see what I can do. I'm not sure. I know we've got all the we keep all the proposals, but I'm not sure that we actually keep the actual RFP.
Yeah.
Right. But let me look, see what I can do.
And on the costing, are the spreadsheets and the formulas in the spreadsheet, however you do it, are they transparent enough that someone other than you could a year later plug in a different value and update the costing?
Yeah, we try to put all of our reports and all of our cost analysis, we try to put them in layman's terms. We don't, you know, so someone that's in the, either, you know, within the authority or, you know, town council people, et cetera, can read them and understand them and know what all the values mean.
Okay, and then I was trying to interrupt before when you were going through the feasibility study permitting process. Could you just unpack a bit the field work part of the feasibility study?
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you.
could you unpack the field work part of the feasibility study? What it is you're doing in the 6 to 8 weeks, the data collection?
Oh, the data that we're collecting.
Yeah.
What we would be looking at, a number of things here. When you're looking at the site itself and looking at what we're doing there, we'd be looking at getting the symmetry of the site, as well as side scan of the site, which would, you know, let us know about the stumps and that kind of information. We'd also be doing geotechnical investigations to look at what kind of material we've got, because that's an important key, not only for the value of the material, but also, you know, as far as does it have a value, but also the different weights and grain sizes of material affect how quickly they can dredge and pump the material and what the costs are. So if you've got something that's a real gravelly sand, it's much harder and much more expensive to pump that 3 miles than it is a loose mud, and that all that factors into the calculations that we do for pricing. Now, we'd also looking at our disposal options is go ahead and, you know, there have been 4 or 5 different things that have been kicked around and talked to us. And the ones I'm going to remember right off the hand were Panorama Farms. There was also the possibility of using some of that land up toward Ray's Ford as a staging area to take it elsewhere, the quarry. Look at some of those sites and evaluate how realistic those sites are for disposal or future use. I know there's also some talk about the airport as well. I don't think that, you know, from what I've seen, I think pumping over there directly is going to be a tough sell, both economically as well as with the airport. But I think Ms. Hutchinson's supposed to talk to that some. But looking at all of those kind of analysis would be done, those investigations, not just the physical site investigations, but also some of the issues with the land and the politics of the land and what that means, so that we could adequately evaluate that in our cost estimates. That would be taken in the first 2 month period.
But the side scan, it only shows what's above the sediment, right?
That's right. The side scan will show us what's above the sediment. And then when we start doing the probings and the vibrocore sampling, that'll tell us what's down within the layers. It'll tell us the various types of material that are there, the stratification, as well as, you know, what we're hitting down there, be it rock or stump. And it'll also give us some ideas, you know, there may be some possibilities in that mid to, you know, upper section of the lake, depending on what the actual valley is shaped like and the underlying rock, there may be some opportunities to gain capacity in those areas by dredging those deeper than the natural grade. That's a possibility to get some extra capacity up in there. But we don't know. We won't know until we get up there and look at the material, the underlying material, whether it's rock or if it's, you know, something we can't get into or it's just too expensive to deal with.
Is the side scan like a bathymetric? Is any
like
of that...
Sonar.
They're both sonar. Bathymetry and side scan are both sonar techniques. What you get with the bathymetry, you get an X, Y, and Z coordinate on the bottom. It's much like your surveyor coming out to survey your yard, and he tells you got an elevation at this point, and that's a fairly exact science. The side scan is also sonar, but what it does is it images the bottom. It doesn't give you elevation with it. It shows you things that are sticking up or holes that are depressed. You're able to see the shadows. So it's almost like you get a black and white picture, and it's horizontally from side to side. You can know where that spot is, but you can't know how deep that spot is. So when you take the two and put them together, then you take the images that you get from the side scan and you lay them over the bathymetry, and you can say, okay, in this one region of the lake, we have a rocky area at 32 feet deep. You can, between the two, you can tell what you've got. So it's a combination of the two to really understand what you're dealing with on the bottom of the lake.
Other questions? Chris, a long time.
Yeah, I know we're keeping you long here, but I have a question regarding the with the RFPs and the permitting process and how it relates to the study. I assume that in your the feasibility study, you wouldn't say, okay, here's three things you could sign to guarantee that you have a disposal site. It would be more your estimate of what are the possibilities and what the pros and cons would be and possibly an estimate of the terms. Is that right?
That's correct.
So we wouldn't be able, or we probably wouldn't then go lock up a disposal site before permitting. Is that also right?
I think that what you would find is that as you went through permitting, you would find permitting conditions, cost, and politics would all shake themselves out. You know, it's one of the things that we try to do, and it's always kind of been my motto, is to give those people that are elected to make the choices, give them all the information they need to make the best choices they can. But it's, you kind of get out of, when you start making the choices for people, you're getting out of the engineering world and into the political world. That's, you know, I like staying in the background and dealing with just the facts, man.
Okay. Well, where I was going with that was I assume that a permitting might, well, I'll just answer it in the form of a question. To get a permit, do you have to specify the disposal point or the route, you know, across land to a disposal point?
That's correct, you do.
You do. And so it sounds like it would be in our interest to have some option or something on a permit site, and then the RFP would have to specify a particular disposal site or, you know, maybe one of two or something like that.
Exactly. You might have, when you go to the RFP, you might have a couple of options. And say, okay, well, we've got, you know what you might wind up with on the lake is you might wind up with, okay, along the lake area, we've got three areas that we can dispose of. And maybe it's for one dredger, it might be more economical to build a large site in the middle and put all of it there, or it may be more economical to build three small sites on land or whatever that we've got easements or acquired, and leave some leeway in there for them to work around their own machinery and their own economies to get the best price for everything. So you don't, you gotta, every option that you leave open for the contractor has to be permitted. You know, if we're going to dredge 2 million yards out of this lake, the regulatory folks are definitely going to want to know where it's going to go. And it can't just be, well, we're going to dredge it and figure it out. That's not going to, we're not going to get a permit that way. We've got to have a plan.
Okay, and I just have one quick question. This probably is not something you can go into any detail on, but I was reading on the web this week about dredging projects, some dredging projects and proposals in Kansas, particularly Mission Lake, and also a bunch of them in Iowa. There's Lake Aquabi removed 420 cubic yards from a lake there, and there are 15 lakes in Iowa that are either restored or in process or planned. I don't know for sure that they all involve dredging. They may involve things like upland mitigation or something like that, but I think at least some involve dredging. Are you familiar with any of those, and are there any lessons? And one other aspect of it, there was a table that showed where the money was coming from, and there was a lot of money coming from a bunch of different sources, including federal money. Do you have any insight on that? Are you familiar with any of those?
I'm not. We have very, very few projects on inland states. Matter of fact, off the top of my head, I can't think of one that I've participated in. Everything's, we've worked on inland projects, but they've been in coastal states. So I really don't know. My guess is if they're getting federal money, it's probably through one of the WERDA bills, which come out, we just had, I think they passed WERDA in 07, which was great, but it means that there won't be another WERDA bill passed. I doubt we'd see one before 2010. They'll put them in. They put them in every year, but it's typically about every third or fourth year they actually get to the point they have to pass one. So the odds of getting authorized as a federal project any time before, you're probably almost too late to get on one that would be 2010. So
okay.
2012, 2014 would be the closest that you could look at to WERDA money.
I won't start counting that money yet.
Yeah.
I wouldn't.
Thank you.
I'm about to say thank you. Has anyone got a very last question?
I have one last question, Mark, because the airport's next on our agenda. May we assume that many of the questions that might come up about the airport, whether it's logistics or appropriateness of the sediment, would be addressed in the feasibility study?
We could definitely address the appropriateness of the material, we can probably address the logistics of it. Just from what I've seen of the site and what I know of the situation there with the FAA, a direct pump to the airport is not very likely at all. I understand that the active runway and pumping and the deal with the birds is an obvious concern. You also have issues there with the fact that the topography of the site, you don't really have flat land off of the runway, and that's why you need material out there for the runway. So building a containment site for that and controlling the water and the water discharge would be very, very difficult. It would probably be easier to put it and stage it somewhere closer to the lake and then truck it up there, move
right,
it mechanically.
Right.
And we can, if that's one of the options we really want, the authority wants us to really, really look at, we'll make sure that's investigated.
But if we wanted to take advantage of the airport purchasing that fill, we would need to own the site that the fill is being dewatered in, right? We need to keep ownership of that sediment.
Well, or negotiate.
Or have something to negotiate. You could lease the land or something negotiated out, but yeah, you would want to make sure whatever you did, if you're going to use that as an economic benefit, that you maintained control over that fill. It just depended on how it went with whatever the land purchase, land lease. You get to where you're talking about the ownership of it. I guess we should let the realty attorney square that one away.
Okay.
But that's that would definitely be something you'd want to do.
Thank you very much.
We're going to email you a cookie.
Thank you. Yeah, we survive on chocolate chip cookies here during our meetings. I'm sorry we can't get one through the wires to you. But,
well, that's quite all right. Thank you for calling us back and letting us give our 2 cents worth on the project.
Oh, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Great evening.
Thanks.